Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, Your Health Connection. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Anxiety is a normal and very appropriate part of life, but at times it can lead to irrational fears. And these fears might affect daily life and can even become disabling. So can we learn something new from the neuroscience literature, and particularly that involving memory mechanisms that can lead to useful new treatment options? We'll be discussing anxiety this next hour with my guest, the New York clinical or cognitive neuroscientist, Dr. Daniela Schiller. Dr. Schiller is a postdoctorate fellow at NYU Center for Neuroscience. Her interest is in research into the neural mechanisms underlying emotional control. If you have any questions or comments during the next hour, please call us at 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And, of course, you can email us at line1, that's all one word, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, at kska.org. Dr. Schiller, welcome to Line 1.
Thank you.
It's nice to have you here. I was really captivated when I first read about this particular problem, I guess because it puts together some really new and exploding research, I guess, in neurosciences with a very, very common problem. Anxiety. Would you mind just taking a second and let's discuss anxiety and phobias and how we might define these processes and how we may label them differently? I know there's different kinds of anxiety disorders, so we get just a general feeling about this problem.
Sure. So the American Psychiatric Association defined anxiety disorders as one category of psychiatric syndromes that are characterized by maladaptive anxiety symptoms that cause distress and impair function. And one important thing to understand about anxiety is that it's different from fear. First of all, fear and anxiety are normal processes. They are adaptive. The problem is when these processes become extreme and affect everyday life. So we can discuss further the particular components that characterize each state.
Yeah, since fear and anxiety are different, if you don't mind, what's the difference? What do we know about them that we can say that they're different?
Well, fear is targeted to a particular source of threat. It's very specific. So it begins rapidly and it dissipates rapidly once the threat is removed. So it's prompted by real danger, and it induces active defensive responses. Whereas anxiety is less specific and less targeted toward less predictable threats. It's more diffused, and it's more long-lasting as opposed to fear, which is short-lasting.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about that. So someone who has a performance anxiety, each time they may get up to give a speech or play a musical instrument, that's more of an anxiety because the real threat there is not clear, and then it's recurrent, whereas with a fear, it's much just shorter lasting. There's something that you see a bear or something, and it's gone, and then you don't have any long term repercussions from that. Is that kind of what you're saying?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, that would be a good example for these differences.
How common are anxieties? And I guess I'm getting back off the storyline a little bit because your research has been into fear, but I was very much interested in the anxiety. How are anxieties very common in the human population?
Yeah, they are actually. The numbers are quite dramatic. About a fifth of the American population would experience anxiety through their lifetime. So the percentage is, they're talking about something like 18%.
Okay. All right. And those are significant anxieties that might impact us on a daily basis, like people who have trouble flying in an airplane and may go so far as to avoid it or have to be somehow take some medications for that kind of problem.
Yeah.
What do we go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
Right, what about the neurophysiology and the anatomy? I know this is on the radio, and it's kind of hard to get a picture, but if you wouldn't mind talking to us a little bit about what we might know that structurally may change or be different about anxiety and fear. Are they stored in different areas? Is there different parts of the brain that is activated during each of these occurrences?
Yeah. So generally, or a simplified description of the neurocircuitry of anxiety disorder would be focusing on three brain regions. One of them is the amygdala. It's a small structure behind our ears at the temporal lobe. The other is behind our forehead, in our prefrontal cortex, right above our eyes. A region called the ventromedial prefrontal cortex. And a third region is a region associated with memory and context learning, which is called the hippocampus. So these three regions are involved in emotion processing, in memory, and in control, top-down control. So, for example, in anxiety, what we would see is enhanced amygdala responses that would correspond to our enhanced fear responses and enhanced anxiety, all the exaggerated responses we see in disorders. And this is due to dysfunction or less function in the prefrontal cortex that in the normal brain it uses to inhibit amygdala responses. And the hippocampus, for example, exerts contextual control. So it tells us when is the appropriate context to express our fear. And when it's dysfunctional, we will express fear in inappropriate area, environments. So that's roughly the dissociation.
In the fear response, and let me back up. I assume that we know these are activated by some of the functional MRI scanning techniques now. Is that true, and are there other mechanisms with which we, or other ways we can elicit what's really going on at the brain, in the brain?
Yeah, there are several strategies. So first of all, there is ample animal research, for example, laboratory rats, and so they can learn to predict, simple events of danger just as people can. So then you can study their behavior in the laboratories. That's one strategy. In humans, you can use non-invasive techniques such as scanning, and there are various techniques of scanning. But also another strategy is to actually do pharmacological studies, to give drugs that would block or enhance certain chemicals in our brain. And perhaps another strategy is to look at patients that had stroke and had damage in particular brain regions, and then you see how they function without these particular brain regions.
Mm-hmm. So there's multiple techniques with which we may get information about what regions or parts of the brains are functioning. What about just bringing up the issue of memory as part of this? What do we know about memory and its role in fear and anxiety and just in general? It seems like this is a hugely important topic right now.
Yeah, so as a natural process, emotion enhances memory. And one of the theories of what's happening in trauma, for example, is that you have a recurring feedback. Whenever you remember, you have this exaggerated emotional response that then strengthens the memory more and more. So it's like a snowball. It just gets stronger and stronger instead of dissipating over time because you have this inhibition of the emotional response whenever you remember. So that's, for example, one relationship between emotional processes and memory.
Do we know yet how memory is actually stored? I've been somewhat interested in this for a long time. 30 years ago, when I was a medical student, I briefly was participating in some research where we gave experimental animals a medicine called puromycin, which inhibited RNA synthesis, with the idea that that may affect memory. And we could teach mice how to go through a maze, and then we'd give some of them puromycin, and they couldn't figure out how to get through the maze anymore. And I think the thought is that may not be really the way that was working. So I've always been fascinated about memory and how it's captivated, how it's stored, and how it's present in our brain, and where is it located, and so forth.
Mm-hmm. So there's a distinction between short-term memory and long-term memory.
Mm-hmm.
Our prefrontal cortex, the frontal parts of our brain, are required for short-term memory or for working memory, just to hold a few items of information in your mind, whereas the hippocampus is required for translating memories from short-term to the long-term. Or amygdala is also required to store emotional memories. So you have some separation in the brain in terms of which region is critical for the consolidation or for the formation of the memory. But memory, in general, I would say, is stored in a very diffused, sparse form across various regions in the brain, especially when memories become older. They become more elaborated, and they require more detailed connections in various regions in the brain. But at the cellular level, neurons in the brain, they interact through little gaps that are called synapses. And these synapses are the regions where neurons communicate with each other. And to make this communication better, you need, like you mentioned, synthesis of proteins to make structural changes in these connections to make them more efficient. So as memory is stored or becomes stronger, you would see structural changes in the brain that are induced through this protein synthesis. And so neurons or these brain cells would have more branches and more efficient communication. And what you might see in anxiety disorders is overgrowth of particular connections or undergrowth of some connections in different brain regions.
So that there's actually some evidence of physical changes in the neurons, either because they are inhibitory or excitatory and so forth, and that seems to be a consequence of the mechanism of memory. Is that what you're saying?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. You would see long-term changes that are apparent in the structure of the neurons in the brain.
Let me just take 1 second to remind our listeners again, you're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection. I'm talking with Dr. Daniela Schiller. We're talking about some fear in particular, but anxiety and memory and neurophysiology. And we're going to shortly get into some research that she's been involved in that may be leading to some opportunities to help control these kinds of disorders. If you have questions or comments, please feel free to give us a call in Anchorage. It's 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-800, or 1-888, I should say, 353-5752. And you can email us at line1@kska.org. It appears to me, from having seen patients for 30 years, that there's quite a bit of difference between individuals in the susceptibility. There's almost a group of people that seem to be genetically predisposed to some anxiety. You can almost see this perhaps early in life in infants. And then all of us also seem to have at times acquired some unusual anxieties. Is there much you can say about what we know about why there's individual differences in susceptibility to anxiety disorders?
Yeah, the research is very interested in these questions, and it's actually been there's been more focus on it in recent years, and there are various factors. So one of them is, as you mentioned, could be genetic. And people are looking for the genes, and there are some genes especially that are related to the expression of a particular neurotransmitter in our brain or a chemical in our brain called serotonin. Other components could be from early stages of development, which are either as a fetus, before birth or immediately after birth. There is some evidence that early trauma could cause later complications or fundamentally change your ability to handle adverse events later on in life. And then there are some recent new findings that are pretty exciting from Dr. Milad in MGH in Boston, who found, for example, differences between individuals in their cortical thickness, in how thick a particular brain region is. In this particular case, it is located in the frontal parts of our brain. That makes people less or more efficient in their ability to extinguish fear memories. So that could be another new interesting direction that could also, of course, be linked to development and to genetics.
Right. This idea that has been becoming more of interest and well-defined of prenatal and even generational stresses affecting us later in life is kind of fascinating and gets into how stress and environment can affect our genetic predisposition, our DNA, by really early on affecting how and when genes are turned on and off. I don't want to get into that too deeply, but I think it's worth mentioning that there are mechanisms that appear to be working that would allow such things to happen, and that leads to much, much more complicated thinking about long-term or illnesses in general. Is that what you're implying and alluding to?
I could allude to that, but in a very careful, speculative manner, because there is no conclusive evidence of genetic disposition, the relationship between the biology and inherited biological structure and these disorders. So, but people are looking into it, and there is some evidence. But in general, in science and research, it's very hard to dissociate environment from our genetic disposition. And for example, there is some evidence that your social environment is enormously important for your ability to cope with stress. And for example, maternal separation in early on in life could affect you dramatically. Also, research about the Holocaust, concept of second and third generation of people who grew up with parents and observing their behavior or learning in very it changes their ability to cope with fear. So I would say all these components are they're mixed, and there's to each direction, so it's hard to say something about that.
All right. We're having a little breakup from, I don't know if it's from your end or my end, but we got most of that, what you were saying. But so there are ways that stresses in our life can have long-term effects. I know there's pretty good evidence that your socioeconomic status may affect the overall outcome. If we look at population health, for example, the health of a population, that it's very well stratified into a socioeconomic strata is related to how your long-term health will be. Is that also kind of what you're alluding to?
There could be very significant effects of your social environment, although not necessarily in the direction of low or high socioeconomic status. Okay. Sometimes you can find it in very more educated levels of society. depending on the particular society and the components of that society.
Okay. We're getting away a little bit from where we and intended to go, so I want to get back to that that area a little bit. And why don't you tell us a little bit about what you're interested in and what you're studying, particularly at New York University now?
So I'm interested in a particular phase of memory that is called reconsolidation. But to understand reconsolidation, we have to understand consolidation. And consolidation is the term used to explain how memories are being stored or initially formed. So first you have an event, and then it is stored through a process called reconsolidation in the brain, which involves these structural changes and between the connections in the cells in the brain that we just talked about. So you see these changes that are occurring through consolidation. And originally, or the classical view of memory, was that memories are formed through this one-time process of consolidation. And whenever you retrieve them from the same pool of memory. So you basically retrieve the original memory, or the way you stored it originally. And then there were some studies in the 60s that didn't continue, but then in 2000 there were additional studies that revived this different theory called reconsolidation. And some of the central researcher of this field, one of them is Karim Nader and Joseph Ledoux, that did and Susan Serra, they did these studies around 2000. And what they found is that memories are undergo consolidation each time they are retrieved, as opposed to this view that this was a one-time process that happened only once. Each time you retrieve a memory, it has to be stored again. Because it has to be stored again, they call it reconsolidation. And what's important about this phase is that it means that memories return to a non-stable state each time you retrieve them. And this is, again, in contrast to what was originally thought, that once you store them, they're safely there, and you'll always remember the same memory. Here it means whenever you retrieve a memory, it's unstable until you store it again. And from an evolutionary perspective, the idea is that it has an adaptive function. It means that you could update the memory. You could store it with information that is available at the time of retrieval. And what it means is that memories are actually being constantly updated.
Mm-hmm.
Or what reconsolidation researchers like to say is that your memory is only as good as your last retrieval of it. Mm-hmm. So I've become interested in that because if indeed we have a window of opportunity to change memories, maybe we can take fear memories, reactivate them, and then let them be stored again, but now incorporating new information. And this new information will be a safe information, a non-fearful one. And perhaps they can be stored now in a less fearful form. That was the aim of the research.
Somewhere while researching this, and it may have been a description that you made that may make this a little bit easier for people to envision, and I want you to set me right if I'm using the wrong analogy, but if we look at a computer and we're writing a Word document, then we put it down, and in a sense, when we save it, we put it into memory. If we take that document back out and change a few words on it and save it again, we've reconsolidated or remembered it, but we've also written over the previous document, and depending on how we save it, it may not be retrievable in its exact format again. Is that a fair analogy?
Yeah, it's a fair analogy, and it's actually helpful in understanding current techniques that are used to treat anxiety disorders. And these techniques are mostly based about new learning. So in a sense, you would have a memory, and now instead of rewriting it, you will just create another memory. So you'll have two documents, and these documents would sort of compete for expression, or which document you're going to retrieve, whereas we were aiming to change the original document.
All right. We're going to take just a short break here for everyone who's listening. We'll be back in about a minute. You're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection. In Anchorage, call 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And you can email us at line1@kska.org. After this short break, we'll be back and discussing what we know about anxiety and memory and some newer psychological possible treatments with Dr. Daniela Schiller. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
If you missed part of today's program, or if you'd like to listen to Line 1, Your Health Connection again, tune in tonight at 8. Remember, tonight's recorded rebroadcast will not be taking telephone calls. Following this afternoon's broadcast, Line 1 will be available on our website at kska.org. This is KSKA Anchorage.
Welcome back to Line 1. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Today we're speaking with a New York University neuroscience researcher and psychologist, Dr. Daniela Schiller, and we're talking about anxiety and some shortly about her recent research into this this area of how we're learning and using memory mechanisms, what we're learning about memory mechanisms to perhaps offer some treatments about fear and perhaps at some point anxiety. If you have questions or comments, you can email us at line1@kska.org. You can call us at 550-8433. Our toll-free number is 1-888-353-5752. Please remember also, if you're listening between 8 and 9, you're listening to a rebroadcast, and we won't be available to answer questions at that time. Dr. Schiller, it seems to be well known, at least in a lot of scientific circles, that our memory in general is not very reliable. Often an important part of court hearings and so forth, but this was brought to my attention recently. I'm going to give a talk fairly soon, and I was researching a comment that was made by a guest on the program. What I remembered the guest saying was not at all what the guest said when I listened to the taped rebroadcast. So we should have really understood that I guess memories can be affected in some way after they're laid down. There must be mechanisms where that's occurring.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we know that there is a lot of evidence that memory is indeed not as reliable as we tend to think it is. But this could be due to various reasons. One could be the way you store it originally. Another is how accessible is the stored memory. Maybe it's hard to retrieve it, or you could retrieve some components of it. Maybe you have different memories, and each time you retrieve a different memory depending on the context. And one option is indeed reconsolidation. Maybe this memory changed over time, and because it was updated, because you retrieved it, and then you stored it with this new information, and perhaps this new information is not at all accurate. So all these components can affect the fate of your memory.
Well, let's get into a little bit about the specific research you did. I think it's kind of interesting to look at how you tried to address this issue of reconsolidation and how manipulation during that period of time may affect the memory of a fear, for example. So would you mind just describing what you did?
Sure. Actually, I'm very happy for the opportunity because it's very important to understand the gap that actually exists between a controlled research or examination under controlled condition in the laboratory and real life. So in the laboratory, you want to induce fear, and then we want to change it. So the way we induce fear is using a process called classical conditioning, or it is also known as Pavlovian conditioning, based on its discoverer, Pavlov, in 1927. And the idea is that you take a neutral stimulus, such as a tone, an auditory tone, or a visual stimulus such as a blue square, and this stimulus, when you, or let's say a blue square, if you present it on its own, it doesn't elicit any responses. It's neutral. So you don't sweat or afraid of it. But then what you do is pair it with an unpleasant outcome. And in the laboratory, we use electric shocks. We give mild electric shocks to the wrist of volunteers. So it's not painful. People can set the level of the shocks themselves. But they need to put it on a level that is very unpleasant, but not painful. So they would mind to get it and try to avoid it or would have emotional responses to it. So what we do is just pair the blue square with this mild electric shock. And after several pairings, the responses that are naturally elicited by the shock are now elicited by the blue square because it is predictive of the shock. Now, when they see the blue square, they know that a shock is going to come or might come. So they start to be afraid of it. And these responses is what we measure in the lab, and then we try to see how they change. And in particular, in the laboratory, we usually use, for example, skin conductance response, which is basically how much we sweat. Cell changes in our sweat response. We put electrodes on the fingers, and we see how much subjects sweat. And another measure could be our startle response. You know, when you hear a startling sound, you sort of jump a little bit. But if you're afraid, you'll jump more. You'll be startled more. So this enhanced startle that is caused by fear, we can also measure. So what we did, we induced such a fear memory in the lab. We taught subject that blue square would predict a shock, and we formed the memory. And then that was day one. Day two, subjects came to back to the lab. And now all we needed to do is to reactivate the memory. So they're not exposed to the shocks, the electric shocks again. They're just being exposed to the blue square again. See blue square? This reactivates the memory because they think about the shock. They're afraid. And now what we do is we think that this exposure opens the reconsolidation window. Because as I mentioned a few minutes ago, reactivating a memory induces this restorage process that is called reconsolidation, and this is our window of opportunity to update the memory. So what we do during the window is now we do a training called extinction training. We just present the blue square again and again, and this induces new learning that the stimulus is safe, that the blue square is safe. So they have a fear memory that was reactivated, and now it will incorporate this safety information. Then on day three, subjects come again to the lab, and now we present the blue square again and just measure the fear response and see if it's still there. And of course, we have control groups, we have other groups, comparisons that weren't reactivated with the memory, or had extinction training, but outside this window of vulnerability, outside the reconsolidation window. And what we found is that we could specifically change the fear response. The fear didn't come back on day three when we did this updating through reconsolidation.
So when the extinction was presented during this window, it's like you've erased the prior memory from the person. They don't have a recollection, so they don't get the expected response when presented with that that fear.
I would say no.
Okay, all right.
I'm very happy sure. for the question because you know, it is very important and important point to emphasize because, yeah, we sort of freely talk about updating memories and erasing memories and preventing mm-hmm. fear, mm-hmm. but actually what we do is prevent the fear response. So what we actually modulate is the emotional response to the memory.
Ah, okay.
And it's not in our particular study, but in other studies, there is evidence that there's actually very little evidence in humans, and in animals, of course, you cannot ask them, but humans, you can ask them, do you remember? And we find that subjects do remember the relationship between the blue square and the shock, but they don't see a fear response. So we actually change just the emotional component of the memory. That's what we think we're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a good thing, you know, because if we could extend it one day to traumatic memories, you don't want to erase whole events in the lifetime of a person, because then there would be just like black spots, and you wouldn't understand why you did this and that in a particular time. But now
right.
you would know. You will remember the content.
Right.
You will just have lower emotional response. So that's a very important question.
Right, right. And I had missed that in looking into this. So that that makes a lot of sense to me, because one of the questions is, do we really want to get rid of memories?
Yeah.
Is that necessarily a good idea?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. It's, I mean, it's not that you made it. It's a problem of the whole field, you know. The whole field talks about erasure and erasing.
Yeah, right,
and,
right.
So, yeah, so it's very important to emphasize this point in every opportunity we get.
Another thing that fascinates me about science is where the inspiration, where the thought, where the idea comes from to think about this approach. Was there previous scientific evidence to suggest that something like reconsolidation happened, and that we could affect that in a way that you have shown subsequently?
Mm-hmm. So the origins of this research is from the animal research, and these studies were conducted initially in laboratory rats, but also demonstrated across various species, snails, rabbits, many, many species. They had these behavioral experiments where you change memory. And because they wanted to test the idea of reconsolidation, one way to prove it was to block it using pharmacological means. So if there's these structural changes between the connections, between the neurons, these require protein synthesis in the brain, and you can block it pharmacologically and see what happens. So they would initiate reconsolidation and then block it pharmacologically and then see if the memory is still there. And it was tested on various forms of memories, scary memories, good memories, passive memories, active memories, memories about actions versus just emotional passive reactions. And so there was a great deal of proof for reconsolidation from these pharmacological studies. And as I mentioned, the idea of reconsolidation originated in the 60s, but there was a burst of studies since 2000 until today. So there's very strong evidence for reconsolidation in animals, but there's hardly any evidence in humans. There are two studies to date that are very encouraging. One study was done on PTSD patients, or post-traumatic stress disorder patients, that were getting also a drug, this pharmacological blockade of reconsolidation. And also another study, a very interesting study, that was done on normal volunteers, also inducing this conditioned fear in the lab and blocking it with pharmacological means. And we've been working also on this pharmacological blockade, but generally speaking, it's very hard to do pharmacological studies in humans. These are invasive mm-hmm. techniques. You mm-hmm. have side effects. Sometimes you see differences between the way men and women metabolize certain drugs. And usually these drugs are just toxic.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't have a lot of options to study these. So ideally you would want a non-invasive technique. And then a colleague of mine, Marie Monfi, in Joseph Ledoux's lab at NYU, had this experiment in laboratory rats, and she did extinction during reconsolidation, but Actually, initially it was unintended. It was actually used as a control group for another experiment or a completely different question. And then she observed this phenomena that she saw a reduction in fear. And first it seems like an odd finding. But when we thought about it, we realized it actually might capture this update idea of mm-hmm. reconsolidation. Mm-hmm. So instead of blocking it, you actually use it as a constructive process. You capitalize on its adaptive function. And when we thought about it after this initial finding, we started designing and running these experiments in parallel in laboratory rats and on normal volunteers in humans, which is where my study came. And we found these parallel results in rats and humans. So that was the way it came about.
Is anybody else working in the same area? Usually the literature gets read, people start thinking, this information gets disseminated. Are there others following this lead like you are?
Sure. There are many laboratories across the world. There's a researcher named Meryl Kind in the Netherlands that she was the first to demonstrate blockade of reconsolidation using pharmacological means. Mm-hmm. And Karim Nader in Canada is leading the research about reconsolidation in rats, also using pharmacological means and diagnosing all these structural changes and cellular and molecular processes. Other people also in the UK, Jonathan Lee and Barry Everett in Cambridge University, they study reconsolidation on positive memories because these are relevant for addiction, for how we become so addicted to rewards that our behavior becomes maladaptive. So, and Suzanne Serra also does research in Paris. So it's all over the world.
Okay. One of the questions I wrote down after thinking about this is, now that we're aware of this reconsolidation and this ability to of extinguish using extinguished training to affect that, are there examples we can think of in the past and perhaps clinical experiences where people have erased, or erased is not the right word, we've modified the emotional response, and maybe we didn't understand what was going on, and now it's become clearer so that there was these natural experiments that we misunderstood, or natural things. I'm thinking off the top of my head, well, what about maybe that's why fear is modified. We realize quickly that we shouldn't have to worry about a bear every day we walk out the back door. Is that in some way being changed by during a reconsolidation period of that experience of fear?
Yeah, I think these are exciting times because we start to change our view of memory. And if we understand that memory is more dynamic and fluent than we originally thought, then we would start reassessing previous phenomena. And it could explain, for example, distortions in the court, like you mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
It could maybe also explain variability in the clinic, in the efficacy of various techniques. Maybe in some techniques you stumble upon the reconsolidation window, whereas in other you don't. Could explain the effects of some drug treatments. So I think once there's, I would say, a paradigm shift in the way we view memory, and it does lead us to view different protocols and experiments and findings differently.
What needs to be done next? What's on the particularly your research agenda, and what others may be thinking about directions with the idea that perhaps this will have some clinical usefulness at some point?
Mm-hmm. My research is done in the laboratory of Elizabeth Phelps, and she leads a strategy in the field of extending animal findings to humans. But instead of going directly into the clinical population, the idea is that first you have to test these phenomena in normal volunteers on their normal brain under very controlled conditions, and then apply them to the clinic. And this is where this particular research is located. And the next phase would be to try and see if this could be implemented in the clinic. Another important question is, what are the neural mechanisms underlying this phenomena? Because it was now demonstrated across species as a behavioral effect. But we don't know what exactly did we change in the at the neural level or the mechanistic level. So research should address that. Another important question is how this controlled model applies to much more extreme, potent, and complex memories that are usually seen in anxiety disorders.
Mm-hmm.
So we need to make this gradual transition in the complexity of the and intensity of the memory. And one last question that I can think of now is that how does this apply to other emotions? For example, positive emotions, as I mentioned, maybe it could apply to addiction, to reward memories. So this, I would say, is the future direction.
You pointed out my lack of understanding at the beginning of the program about the difference between fear and anxiety. And so I'd like to come back to that since the anxiety issue is more of a clinical issue perhaps than the fear. Do we have reason to think that we can, that the mechanisms are the same and that reconsolidation windows might be useful in affecting anxiety, or is that still yet to be seen, as you implied, as an area where we need to look more?
It's actually very recent research that has started to look at the difference between fear and anxiety, and both could become could be under the category of anxiety disorders. Only some of them would be more generalized fear, and some would be more specific fear, like you mentioned, like in phobia versus panic disorders that are more generalized. But in terms of the neural mechanisms, the amygdala has been found to be critical for the acquisition, expression, and retrieval of fear memories when they are modeled, especially through classical conditioning, you know, these simple associations between a stimulus and an aversive event. But for anxiety, people started to notice some a region adjacent to the amygdala, which is actually, by some researchers, considered a continuum with the amygdala. It's called the bed nucleus of stria terminalis. It's a very complex name, but people like Michael Davis and Christian Grillon have been pushing such research that in the laboratory dissociates between fear and anxiety, and they start to map these different neural mechanisms.
What about the length of this reconsolidation window? What do we know about that? Do we know things that might extend it? So I'm envisioning in a clinical situation, we may have limited amounts of time. So do we know anything specifically about that window that you mentioned is so important?
There is evidence, which again comes from the animal research, and of how long it requires to do these molecular and cellular processes that are required for the storage of the memory. And it takes about 6 hours. That's the evidence we have. In humans, we found a similar window, but this is just by boring the same parameters, not through a very detailed parametric examination of the window. So this is also a topic for future studies, to understand the window, how long it is, and what affects the length. It might be, for example, that that memories that differ in strength have different windows, or depending on the age of the memory, but there's no evidence as of yet. It has to be further examined.
And you also said, I think, at the beginning that the emotion does have some impact on perhaps the strength of a memory. I'm thinking of how adrenaline or something, chemicals like that in our body that respond to stress may, at certain amounts, have a much more potent effect on memories, and therefore will that also affect the ability to keep the emotion out of our memories?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. One of the strategies now is to treat patients immediately as they come to the emergency room after trauma, to reduce this enhancing emotion. The enhancing effect induced by emotion to prevent later trauma from developing. That's one strategy. But it might be that's exactly what we aspiring for in this reconsolidation research on emotional memories. If you miss this initial window that the memory was formed and already strengthened by the strength of emotion, maybe you can later on change it just by inducing the emotional memory again and then removing the impact of the emotion.
And again, I may be over-extrapolating a little bit, but it sounds like one of the things that is important if we do have a post-traumatic stress-like experience or we have some very emotional anxiety-producing event, that this model, this way of thinking about it, it does make sense to have early intervention, perhaps with cognitive behavioral-like therapies to affect the long-term consequences, and so that this may provide some bit of understanding for that, or am I way out there in extrapolating this data?
No, I think you point very accurately, but also the change in strategy, because what actually we did in this study is merging two approaches. Because extinction training is an approach that has been used in the clinic, and also reconsolidation is a separate field tried to target memories. And what we did in this particular study is just merged extinction training with reconsolidation. And another way to merge it is perhaps to use cognitive strategies of cognitive reevaluation, and maybe to combine this with drugs. For example, drugs that enhance learning and enhance memory. So if you can teach new memories or teach new information to be incorporated in a memory, maybe you can further facilitate it with a drug. So all this, the combination of these various techniques at various time points, early on, immediately after, these are all approaches that are being investigated, but they're also we're starting to have a merge in these approaches.
Little bit off the subject, but there's also been a lot I've been hearing and reading about the importance of sleep in learning and memory, and I'm going to say the word consolidation, and maybe that's not the right thing to say. Are you able to comment on the importance of sleep in learning and memory?
Yeah, it's not my field of research, but one researcher that has been leading such questions is Matthew Walker, and you correctly said that consolidation, there is evidence that consolidation is definitely related to sleep, and what Matthew Walker showed is that also reconsolidation is related to sleep, and if you prevent sleep, you don't see effects of, or you can prevent effects of on reconsolidation. So there is evidence along these lines. About the need of sleep.
Maybe one more question just to get a little bit more generalized. We hear the term brain plasticity used a lot. What does that generally mean to you as an appropriate concept, and how does that perhaps relate to some of the research you're doing?
I would say it relates to plastic changes in the structure, which means that the connections between the brain cells are being modified. brain cells develop more branches that are used for communication. And basically, as the brain matures, you don't get more cells. You're actually born with a fixed number of brain cells, and roughly this is how you end. But what is changing over time is these connections. So these are the plastic changes. That's the way our brain works. And if we try to capitalize on these processes to enhance or to prevent certain memories or certain processes in the brain.
And so to maybe extend that a little bit more, is that the more we use our brain, the more we may keep these changes happening. And then if we don't use the brain, is that necessarily not good?
Yeah, there's definitely evidence and a line of research that is related. It's called enriched environment. Mm-hmm. And it shows how when you have more stimuli in the environment, you know, to stimulate your brain in various modalities, how it enhances the later ability to learn and to remember and enhances your cognitive functions. And sometimes it's related to aging. Your memory sometimes lasts longer. I mean, these are very sometimes there is evidence along these lines. I wouldn't say too. I don't want to say too much, you know, bold statements, but there's definitely evidence in this direction that plasticity is related to your cognitive function and environmental circumstances and the way you use your brain throughout your life. Of course, in addition to genetics and all sorts of and food and biological components, all these interact to end on how your brain functions.
We have about a minute left, and I'll ask you the million-dollar question from my standpoint. If you were to predict, do you think this line of research that you're involved in is going to provide some clear-cut clinical application for anxiety?
I would have to say I don't know. I hope so. I very much hope so. It's very promising and exciting, and there is a lot of there's incredible amount of effort all over the world and a lot of funding directed in this direction, but we'll have to see. I mean, this is exactly what we want to find out now.
Right. And that's what real science is all about. It's you just follow the facts. You don't know where it's going to lead. You don't want to make too much in the way of predictions. I understand, and I really, really appreciate your taking the time to help me and our listeners understand this new evidence about neuroscience.
Sure. Thank you for hosting me.
Yeah. Have a good afternoon and good evening.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye. Next week, we're going to return, as you may be aware, and one of our more popular topics over the last several years has been podiatry, problems of the foot and ankle. Dr. Ken Swayman will be making his fourth debut here, or fourth appearance, I should say, and we'll be addressing your questions and comments about disorders of the foot and ankle. I want to also mention that tonight there's going to be a special presentation on the effects of chemicals on reproductive health by a Dr. Jansen of the Natural Resource Defense Council. This will be at the Anchorage Museum from 6:30 to 8 tonight. You can get information at 222-7714. Pat Yak is Vice President of APTI News and Public Media. Kristen Spacht helped me today by engineering the program. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line 1, Your Health Connection, is a production of Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. Today's program is available on our website at kska.org. CD copies can be purchased by calling 550-8400. This is KSKA Anchorage.